Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Ida Donovan. Ida is a lecturer in gender and global political economy at the University of Sussex, UK. Her research interests are in anti-colonial political thought, Marxism, gender studies, and histories of internationalism from below, in quotes. She is co-editor of The Black Mediterranean, Bodies, Borders, and Citizenship, which was released in 2021. And she's the author of Resisting Racial Capitalism, An Anti-Political Theory of Refusal. It is a pleasure to have Ida on The Deep Dive with me. How are you? This morning for me, afternoon for you. How are you?
Hi, Philip. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm pretty good. And I'm glad that you are being bathed in some unusual London sun. Yeah. That doesn't happen very often.
No, it's very unusual, especially for you today, I suppose.
Yeah. Let's celebrate that. London sun be like, nah. And that's just official motto. I'm just not showing up. So deal with it. You know, I was, you know, going through the book over the course of the last week. And I think sometimes there's a lot of parallels in the universe. And I feel like these past 3 to 4 years, besides being incredibly trying years in many respects, and I'm talking from a political and social perspective, I'm actually quite happy in my life. But the rest of it's all going to shit. And in within your book, there's a, it's weird that I'm starting with this, but I want to make sure that I get to it. Cedric Robinson features quite prominently throughout the book from an ideological perspective. As I was reading it, I noticed you also spent time with another guest that I had on the show, Joshua Myers, who teaches at Howard, and he wrote a biography of him and also featured him quite prominently in his book of Black Study, which is where I spent the episode of Deep Dive talking with him. And I feel like there's been it sounds unfair to say like revitalization or rediscovery of his work because his work is so and so present, but I feel like it's, I feel like I see it surfacing more, being referenced more, being connected to other works. Like you did that incredibly interestingly and well in your book. So I want to give you an opportunity to connect his work to your work, because I think that's a key feature of the book. And then we'll go from there. Am I seeing something in Cedric's work being more critically in the ether in your mind?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in suggesting that, of course, there's been a kind of renaissance, right, in terms of thinkers and organizers and scholars kind of rediscovering Robinson's work that has happened in the last 10 years or so and has really been spearheaded by people like Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Robin Kelly, and of course, Joshua Myers, who's done really incredible work in terms of bringing Robinson's work to the wider kind of scholarly audiences. I think, at least in my discipline, when people first started to notice this work, there was a lot of emphasis on this concept of racial capitalism, which makes sense why that became so popular at that point in time, right? This was after the financial crisis in 2008, right? And I think a young generation of scholars was once again starting to pay attention to capitalism, right? And as many forms of violence. And Robinson's work at that point in time seemed to offer a way to understand how capitalism has always been racial and colonial. And so that has inspired many different types of writers. What I'm trying to do in my book, and this partly actually builds on important work that Myers has done, is to look not only the book where Robinson introduces this concept of racial capitalism, which is this text, Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition, that was first published in 1983, but it's an attempt to suggest that actually that book features as one work alongside a much wider set of writings, right? That also includes his first book, The Terms of Order, as well as later writings, including An Anthropology of Marxism. And the argument that I make in my book is that if we actually start to pay attention to all of these other bits and pieces of writing, then we will understand that Robinson's critique of racial capitalism is part of a much broader project in terms of thinking about the violence of the state, as well as Western political theory in general.
That gives us like a good opportunity to really get into the meat of the book, because I think it asks the reader some really important questions, or poses an opportunity for the reader to engage with a lot of ideas that when you've existed in a Western way of thinking, almost seem like a physical rule of the way the world operates. Like I like to say that, you know, I don't think I coined this, but, you know, none of these ideas are the natural order of the world, right? They're not gravity in that respect, right? They are man-made, you know, created by us. There are certain systems in which we've chosen to operate, right? Having said all that, they can somehow still feel inevitable. And while understanding they're different, you know, if you read or even a tacit viewer of the news, the world seems to operate in two poles, right? There's those who are capitalists, and then there's socialists to a certain extent, and they are locked in a philosophical and sometimes physical battle with one another for destiny, right? That's the Fox News way of thinking of the world. But I think what your book does is offer an alternative to question the inevitability of some very seemingly basic ideas. And one of those is the notion of the state itself. And so I'd love for you to start there, because I think a lot of things hinges on that idea of the relevance, the meaning of the state at all, you know? And so let's jump in and kind of, I want to give you an opportunity to walk through a bit of that thesis of the basic nature of the state, and how do we confront that with ideas like this?
Yeah, maybe to just say at the start, right, my way into thinking about all of this was actually confronting many of those ideas that you described as dominant or hegemonic, and the realization that I had quite early on in writing the book is precisely this idea that the state is central to the imagination, not only on the right, which of course, as we all know, tends to revolve around ideas around authority, law and order, the rule of law, and so on, right? But equally, and this was, I think, what was so important to me, it was the realization that in so much socialist thinking, right, thinking on the left, the state is equally hegemonic. And even in scholarship that I read very enthusiastically and that I learn so much from, my scholarship on policing and on bordering, for example, there's often a tendency to suggest that these are bad features of the state, but perhaps there are other features that are worth preserving, that could be reformed, be perfected, and so on, right? That might offer some kind of alternative to this idea of the carceral state. And so that was really the starting point for me to kind of push that further and to ask, actually, what is the relationship between state power and racial capitalism? So the book grapples with that predominantly by drawing on Robinson's work, but it also supplements that with insights drawn from C.L.R. James, Sadie Hartman, Jack Halberstam, and so on. And the argument that I make is that by historicizing the state, we can understand that what we today understand as the state in the Western traditional political thought really emerges together with racial capitalism in Europe in the late medieval period. And from the beginning, it really evolves as a kind of counterinsurgency that in very violent ways attempts to crush various forms of social movements that exist in Europe at that point in time, and that are calling for an end to feudalism, an end to hierarchical forms of authority, an end to property. These are movements that are looking for more democratic and egalitarian ways of living. So the book traces all of that and suggests that we are wrong if we think that the state is some kind of neutral entity. Those of you listeners that are schooled in or that have come across liberal political theory will know that oftentimes liberal thinkers say that the state is a pod of individuals that have somehow freely come together and they've consented to be governed. And I attempt to push against that by saying that actually, right, the state arises to power as part of this ruling class response to these social movements. And it's really only through that that we get the birth of bourgeois political theory, right? That tends to really center around these themes of how to be governed, right? How to master, how to discipline populations, and so on and so forth. But the main question there is never one of what might it mean to not be governed at all, right? The main paradigm revolves around governance, domestication, and so on.
It's curious to me because so often, I think I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. We don't really understand, or there's not a deep understanding of words that we use so often, right? Like particularly in I think these kind of casual social environments, like maybe where folks are, you know, deeply scholared and in academia, you know, these kind of hallowed halls of academia, so to speak, there's better understanding of words like simple words. Well, simple sounds like I'm judging, you know, capitalism, Marxism, bourgeois, right? Like, you know, these are words that are thrown around so often. And the reason why I'm kind of coming at it this way, because there are ideas of anarchy, right? Like anarchism, like is that a reasonable alternative, right? And I think a casual person hearing, we should just have anarchy, right? Like those are the words that the right in particular uses to describe social democracy, right? Like if you allow people free transport, you give social services, we'll just have anarchy, right? So it's a word that's kind of heavily loaded, I think. You know, if I'm putting on my branding hat, I would offer anarchy has a bad brand, right? It's hard to sell that in to the average person walking down the street. That's a part A. Like, how do we confront the lack of deep understanding of some of these words? And as someone who considers myself firmly on the left of the left, you know, as I kind of still continue to go through a political and social, you know, learning and unlearning and all the things, you know, we're never done with that journey. You know, when I see the people that throw around the word anarchy most loosely in some regard, I'm like, that's just crazy white people talk, right? Like these are a bunch of like long-haired nuts that don't really get it, right? So I always feel like someone like Cedric Robinson was maybe confronting that similar thing in his day and was given what I call the yeah right face that brothers do when we hear crazy white people and we're like, what you talking about, right? And we just, like, everything sounds like that in our head, even as we're like, mm-hmm. But we're like, man, come on, you know? So I think that's part of it, right? So I want to get your reflections on that. First, sort of the definition and the kind of casual understanding of these terms and how that affects the branding of them. And then the sort of crazy whiteness of anarchy, how that feels to, I think, the average brother out there. Me being an archetype for the average brother.
Yeah, you know, when I started writing this book, I didn't think of myself as an anarchist. And that is something that has only come to me, right, for the process of really working through all of this material and asking this question of what could life be if we didn't have the capitalist state. And so I share your suspicion of anarchism in many ways. And of course, right, there's a long-standing tradition of that tradition as being very eurocentric, as being quite white, often quite middle class as well, being naive and utopian. And what I find very interesting about many of the thinkers that I engage with in the book, and this includes Robinson, is that in spite of the fact that they oftentimes were also deeply critical of this European tradition of anarchism, in spite of all of that, they suggest that there are other anarchist or anti-statist traditions that can be found, right, among peoples that historically might not have featured very prominently in academia. And so Robinson thinks about this in terms of the Black radical tradition, for example, which, of course, has never been a statist project, right? Like, Black radicalism has never been about ceasing the state or reforming it. As Robinson shows in his work, right, scholars like C.L.R. James and W.E. Du Bois, through their work, really begin to open up this question of what does freedom and liberation actually mean? And might that require actually transcending the state, thinking about other ways of organizing ourselves communally and socially. In the book, I also look at other traditions, including indigenous traditions across the world, that equally harbor what we might think of as being anarchist traditions, even though historically that is not how these traditions have been necessarily thought of or referred to. But I think it is an important insight, right, that the white tradition of anarchism does not have a monopoly on anti-statist thinking. And there are other traditions that exist and that have existed and that does provide alternative ways of thinking about how to live beyond and despite the violence of the state. And so I hope maybe that in some ways begins to move beyond the suspicion of anarchy is just an inherently suspicious word.
Absolutely. Mm. And I found that's what's so interesting about the book, right? And the ideas presented is that it really does provoke you to think of things in a completely different way. Utopia is actually not a word that I run from or that I feel is a challenging concept in the sense that, you know, I find again that folks who want to dismiss ideas will say, oh, you think this is going to be a utopia? Nothing's perfect, right? Like, you know, perfection and utopia have somehow become linked in some way. And I think it's actually valuable to de-link them in order to kind of get toward a better. And I think you do this quite provocatively when you start to talk about other worlds, right? Which again, in a Western perspective is usually the domain of science fiction and fantasy and that kind of stuff. And very rarely does it, outside of platitudes and sort of sloganeering, enter into social and political and economic thought. And what you and many others, as you kind of trace through the lineage of this idea, it's offering the notion that we can, other worlds can also be in this way of thinking, right? Political, economic, social, what have you. So I want to give you an idea to kind of talk about anti-politics, right? Which I, as a, again, putting on the branding hat, seems like a better way to go, and how that leads toward a utopia. So kind of linking anti-politics as a movement kind of in conflict with the state, but by being in conflict with the state moves toward a utopia. So kind of walk us through a little bit of that idea.
Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes when people think about utopia, right, they fall back into this way of thinking that suggests that utopia is some kind of distant future or some kind of faraway land, right? And the suggestion that I make in the book and very much kind of by working through thinkers like C.L.R. James, is this idea that actually, right, like the seeds of utopia are present already here and now. And it's a matter of understanding that and thinking with those utopian traditions. And so that's really what the book attempts to do. And so I come at this through this concept of the anti-political, which is a concept that I borrow from Cedric Robinson. And Robinson introduces it really in his first book, which emerged from his PhD dissertation. It's called The Terms of Order. And in that book, Robinson suggests that outside of the political, which he suggests, right, includes the state, but in fact also the entire Western tradition of political thought with its ways of thinking about social life and so on. Again, through these master categories of domestication, governance, and so on. Beyond all of that, suggests Robinson, right, there are communities, societies, and groups that practice other ways of living, of being, and of breathing. And he refers to them as being anti-political. He then kind of expands on this later on in other pieces of writing. And what I really attempt to do in the book is to suggest that actually these anti-political traditions are in many ways global. Right, you can see expressions of them really across the world in diverse groups and in diverse societies. And in thinking with these traditions, I think I'm partly trying to push against the idea that to suggest that things could be different is to fall back into this mode of orientalizing or of exoticizing, which is an accusation that I think thinkers often get, right, when they say that actually, look, here are different modes of living. And the suggestion that I make is that we actually have to take these traditions very seriously. That doesn't mean always and inherently accepting them, right, 100%, but it does suggest, right, taking them as subjects of theorizing and asking questions around what could be learned from that. So the suggestion that the book makes is really that here are expressions of utopian modes of theorizing that really dare to open up these questions around what could life be, right, beyond capitalism, colonialism, and the state.
You know, I also felt like, you know, the capitalist model, which, you know, it's won right now, right? Or it's winning, or it's had a long streak at the very least. However you want to define it, capitalism is the story, right? And I often joke around, you know, when I get comments from listeners, and some of them are it's an attack. Other times it's an observation. They're like, you know, capitalism comes up a lot, right? Like, you know, in that grumpy voice, right? And I'm like, well, that's because it's pervasive, right? Like, I'm not seeking it out. It's woven into the story. And the capitalist story of who we are as beings, our relationship to the planet, is in and of itself a mythology, right? Because And you did this really well, which is why I jotted it down. Like, there's a mythology story of progress, right? And the state leads us through the progress. It's inherently necessary because either we are terrible as beings, right? Sometimes that's through the Judeo-Christian lens, right? Like, we're here, original sin, all that bullshit. Others just more of the, you know, it's person against person. We got to fight. And if we don't, the state regulates the fight, right? It stops us from killing each other. And it's so popular in dystopian concepts, right? Like, the minute the military falls apart after they failed to stop the zombies, we're now all in tribes, you know, murdering each other over like ding-dongs and gas, right? And that's a pervasive story, right? Like, the zombie stuff is kind of meant as a joke, but many people think that, right? That, like, if this all falls apart, the minute we allow ourselves to succumb to our baser instincts, right? And I think that has a perspective on what the world looks like, right? Nature is something to be controlled or defeated, and we are something to be also controlled. So I'm curious your thoughts on how that mythology plays such a central role into understanding how the state operates in the first place.
Yeah. The first thing that you said there, right, like, another way of thinking about this through the traditions that I have been schooled in throughout university is that, right, this is liberalism. This is what liberalism really tells us. So thinkers like, most prominently, Thomas Hobbes, this is the idea that unless we had the state, right, we would all be effectively drawn into this, like, civil war where we all have to fend for ourselves and our most basic instincts would come to dominate, right? In Hobbes's language, life is nasty, brutish, and short. There would be war of all against all. I really push back against this in the book. And I mean, there are several ways in which I do this. But one thing which is really important to point out is, of course, that thinkers like Hobbes don't arrive at this conclusion in a vacuum. Right? He's very much writing in the context of empire and British colonialism. And the inspiration that he really takes from this is by looking at indigenous societies across the Americas and suggesting that, look, here are stateless societies, like they live in this so-called state of nature. And because of that, they're less civilized, right, than the English. So this becomes a way of justifying why these people, right, are less than human and why they can be colonized. And so from the very beginning, right, like this way of thinking about the state, like, again, serves as a kind of legitimizing tool that really paves the way for colonialism. And so in that sense, this mythology is very dangerous. These things, of course, like, don't just show up in the past, right? They very much continue to frame how many people, even on the left, right, think about a range of social issues. I mean, we can think of one example just with policing, right? Often there's this kind of similar suggestion there that unless we have this kind of thin blue line that kind of preserves the border between civilized society and criminality and so on, right, there would just be utter and sheer chaos. And again, these are ideological constructions. These are mythologies that really perform a kind of work. And so the book really tries to unravel that and to suggest that none of these things are natural or normal. And there's a reason for why they exist. But of course, the good thing about realizing that they are historically constituted is that it also opens up ways for taking seriously the idea that things perhaps could be different, right? Could be otherwise.
In one of the words that I felt bared some discussion was this notion of order. Right. Like it comes up so many times, right? Like even, I mean, America's a disaster, but I mean, has been for a long time. Like that's not a new idea, but so many things are often couched in this term of order, right? There's disorder, and that disorder is usually Black and brown people. And so when folks say, I'm the law and order candidate, I'm like, what you really mean is you're the candidate that's here to like stamp down on like Black and brown people in some kind of way, right? Because they always represent disorder. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's slightly less obvious, but still, you know, I think anyone with any observational ability will understand that. But you have, you know, many, many Black folks who are caught up in the same idea, right? So I'm not even suggesting that these are just ideas of white people. That's why I'm saying that this is so pervasive, because you know, I've debated with friends around the issue of policing, right? You know, in the aftermath of George Floyd, for example, it was like, let's call it slightly peak moment for abolition of police, right? Very, very brief window. I'll underline, right? Where at least this was an idea that not new and not because of George Floyd, but it started to get a little bit more of a conversation in the aftermath of George Floyd. And I talked to lots of my friends who were like, oh, you know, yes, I understand cops are terrible, but who are you going to call when something pops off, right? Like everybody likes the idea of there being no cops until someone's coming in your house, right? Even though I've lived in Brooklyn all my life and literally no one has ever come inside my house, right? So I feel like it begs us to define order. Like, what do we mean by order? Because that's kind of, I think, key to ceding power to the state or not, right? So I want to give you an idea to kind of play around with that for a little bit. And maybe you'll help us along the way.
You know, I think oftentimes when people approach this question, right, they do so through this understanding that we have the state on the one hand, and that we might have, right, the economic system that we all live under, capitalism on the other, right? We have this division between the political on the one hand and the economic on the other. But of course, what I work towards in the book is this idea that actually, right from the beginning, racial capitalism has been a political economy. Right? It has always been an order that has been centered around racialized forms of extraction, expropriation, where the mantra is really one of accumulate, right, by any means possible. And so, of course, right, when people talk about policing, right, or just the state in general, and oftentimes the suggestion is that these are institutions that are somehow needed to safeguard civil society and civil order. But again, the point is, right, that these are things that have always been inherently violent, right, that are premised on various forms of exclusions, on violent forms of inclusion as well. And so in that sense, right, like order is not the kind of peaceful mechanism that we sometimes understand it to be, but actually, right, capitalist, racial capitalist order is really premised on various forms of hierarchies, differences, and so on.
And, you know, those hierarchies, I think, are really important, right? Because, you know, I can only use an American kind of framework to discuss things because this is the place where I live, right? So I know it the most. And I think folks recognize the hierarchies. They just desire to be at the top, right? Like they're like, oh, everything will be okay as soon as I get wherever, right? I get a title that gets me into a job that gives me proper healthcare, right? So, you know, healthcare, American healthcare is great, but as long as I have good healthcare, it's all good, right? And I interviewed Timothy Snyder, so another callback to another guest of the show, and he's obviously a scholar around Eastern European politics and genocide and things like that, but. My most recent conversation with him, which is by now a couple years ago, I believe a couple years ago, he wrote a book around healthcare and health and making the suggestion that if you're no society is free if people are not healthy, right? If you don't have the ability to access and have and implement proper healthcare, then does society in and of itself is inherently unfree, right? Because that's one of our most basic tenets. I'm simplifying the concept of the book. And it pushes in from a healthcare perspective, this idea of confronting hierarchy. And I wonder if we do that enough. Again, hierarchy is one of these ideas that begins to feel like the natural order of things, right? That those who have the most merit, those who have proven to be the best at something should be the leader of something, right? Like, look at sports. The best player is the captain, right? And all that kind of stuff. If you're going to build a team effectively, there has to be a hierarchy, right? To use racialized language, people would say this all the time here. I don't know, maybe it's a popular saying other places, you know, oh, that team failed because there was too many chiefs and not enough Indians, right? Like, again, very racialized way of thinking about things. So even when we discuss to whatever limited knowledge most people understand the variety of indigenous societies, what does it come down to? Chiefs and Indians, right? So the notion of hierarchy, right? It's one of the things that I would suggest maybe seems the most natural, right? There's the head of, there's one lion leads the pride, right? There's a queen bee who leads the hive, right? Like, how do we think through and offer a flattening of hierarchy that then supports these anti-political ideas in a sense, right? Because I think it does allow room for expertise, right? There's griots have a certain role in society, midwives, people who have a certain knowledge. So it's not like anyone suggests that, hey, anybody could deliver a child, right? So I'll stop there and kind of give you an opportunity to weigh in on that notion.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to suggest that this idea of hierarchy is so ingrained in our imagination, the idea that these things are natural and we can observe them not only across various societies, but also supposedly in nature. My suggestion is that actually we only come to think about these hierarchies, right, through a tradition of theorizing, right, which is very interested in reproducing these hierarchies. These things are not necessarily natural or biological, right, but they are socially crafted and created and can, for those reasons, also be undone. That doesn't mean, right, that there's no place for expertise, right, or for elderly people, right, that might have experience and so on. That's not at all the argument, but the point is instead, right, which is one about how we organize ourselves collectively and socially. And it's this idea that politics should somehow be left to experts. It's really that idea that I'm trying to push against, right, by suggesting that actually, right, that is a faulty idea. And again, we can observe various communities and groups around the world that choose to organize themselves in ways that, from our point of view, looks non-hierarchical.
And that's also a little bit of a class argument as well, right? That, you know, you have to have a certain pedigree, you have to come from certain stock. And at one point, maybe we recognized that that was family name, right? And now again, here in the US, it's a function of education, right? Education has been, higher education in particular, has been one of those places where the unwashed can get into the washed category, right? If you go to the right boarding school, you go to the right, primarily Ivy League school. I think that's where the right here has chosen these places to kind of stake out their ideological ground, right? They realize that those areas can still be seen in a way of moving from one, again, hierarchy, one class to another. So we have to guard those spots as closely as possible because they are limited in supply, right? So we got to make sure that anything that looks like we're giving folks a leg up, quote unquote, we eliminate those, right? Because again, this is a meritocracy, right? This another mythology, right? The best get the thing. So if you got the thing, it's because you're the best, not because you're just white. You know, so I think that the class dispute becomes a part of this, right? And that is seductive in the sense that, you know, so much of the American story is one of moving, social mobility, they call it, right? Which sounds like a good idea, right? I was a son of a sharecropper, as George Jefferson used to say, and now I own, that's an old school reference. I don't know if many listeners will remember the Jeffersons, but it was a sitcom from the 70s and 80s. And, you know, the title character used to say he was the son of a sharecropper, and now he owns, like, you know, seven dry cleaning stores, right? It's the symbol of success. We're moving on up is literally the theme song of the Jeffersons, right? So this idea of social mobility, especially for those who are at the bottom, again, the place domained by Black and Brown people, is a very seductive idea. And it feels aspirational, right? We literally call it aspirational marketing, right? You don't have a Lexus and now you do, right? How do we tell a branding story that confronts these ideas that seem so benign, but yet are so much a part of how power of the state maintains itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question and like relevant not only in the US, but also where I'm based in the UK, right, where there are similar narratives around social mobility, meritocracy and so on. And oftentimes, I mean, people will refer to the political class in this country and suggest that actually, right, it's never been more diverse, the groups of people that govern us. And that in and of itself seems to indicate, right, that actually there is such a thing as meritocracy. I agree, right? These are very powerful narratives. And my argument is not at all that racial capitalism has historically remained static, right? These things evolve. And one of the ways through which the system adopts is, of course, by co-opting, right, various forms of rising middle classes, for example. And I think in many ways that is what has happened under neoliberalism, both in the UK and also in the US, right, that certain groups of people have been welcomed into the elite. But of course, that goes hand in hand with a violent clampdown on those that are at the bottom of the hierarchy, right? So Black, brown, and Indigenous communities, right, both in the Americas, but also here in the UK. And I think it's important that that we're not seduced, right, by this idea that things are actually removing and supposedly moving in a direction which leads to racial justice and so on and so forth. Because for the vast majority of people, things have actually not changed that much. If anything, right, policing, incarceration, and bordering practices have really intensified and accelerated in the last couple of decades. And so, yeah, staying focused on that is, I think, important.
Absolutely. The violence perpetrated, you know, state-led violence it feels everywhere. And I wonder about this, and I'm gonna get us toward the end here. Oftentimes, for someone like myself, so I'll kind of personalize this, the state can feel like this other that gives you sort of ideological cover in the sense, right? That if you're someone who recognizes state violence, right? I could say to myself, well, you know, the United States is a incredible purveyor of violence all around the world, financially and physically. And, you know, but I recognize that as a person sitting here in Brooklyn, and I don't support it, right? So somehow I'm out, right? But, you know, I could say, you know, what's one of my usual lines? Well, my tax dollars go to, you know, the exportation of violence all around the world, but I personally don't want that, right? But I got no choice but to pay taxes, or they'll throw me in jail. So what's a guy to do, right? Like, I don't want to drop bombs on anybody, but hey, tax man comes for us all, and I live here. That's a part of it, right? I go to Target, cheap shit here is due to violence someplace else, right? You know, we have an awful mayor, and he's confronting a so-called migrant crisis, right? Like, I read these words and I'm like, well, there's no real crisis, right? The violence that these people are fleeing is because of the United States, right? Like, no one leaves your home from 3,000-4,000 miles away and decides, oh, I'm just going to walk with my family to New York, right? Or, well, they walk to Texas and then they get shipped to New York, right? They're leaving for a reason, right? And that reason is steeped in American empire and violence, right? But because I have knowledge of those things, that's the state. That's something that the state is doing, right? Whether Biden or Trump or whoever else. So my question is, how do someone like myself and others, right, kind of not use the arguments presented here with the state to absolve ourselves from what's happening in the world around us, right? Because it can't be as simply as, well, I refuse to vote, or, you know, I'm going to speak out against these things. Like, you know, just something that I, as a person living in this, I often just kind of keeps me up at night. So help me sleep better. What's a possible solution to this conundrum?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? Because again, I think the state is so pervasive in lots of thinking, right, on the left as well, right? So, like, I see very strongly in the UK, where, of course, there was a lot of positive momentum around the Corbyn campaign a couple of years ago, right? And I'm not necessarily having an argument with that, right? But the suggestion is that this, in and of itself, doesn't actually disrupt, right, what you previously referred to as order, right? This underlying form of violence that really structures everyday life around the globe. The same thing here, really, with the post-colonial state, right? It's often a critique that gets made against anarchism is precisely this idea, but surely, right, state building was absolutely central to the national liberation wars that took place across the global south. And that is absolutely true, right? But at the same time, we have to recognize that at that point in time, there were many different forms of decolonizing movements, and some of them were deeply critical of the state and suggested that actually, right, with the attainment of state power, then post-colonial elites might actually become complicit in Western forms of imperialism. And in the book, I try and work through some of these things to suggest that in many places around the world, this is actually been the case, right? And some of these states have also been complicit in their own forms of imperialism, right? Targeting indigenous populations and so on and so forth and so forth. And so again, right, like the state is kind of seductive in that sense, I suppose. And that raises the question of, well, what can people do then? And I mean, the simple answer is organize, right? Together with communities and with different groups, right? And I mean, these things don't necessarily have to be that difficult, right? Like it can include things like joining anti-raid groups, right? That really try and prevent people in the community, right, from being deported, getting picked up by the police and ending up in detention centers, right? Where I live, there are various forms of cop watch groups, right, that also try and keep the local community safe, right? And these things might seem like they're far away from, right, actually getting rid of the state. But the suggestion is that small forms of action, right, that we take in our everyday life, right, really begin to kind of open up this horizon for what it could be, right, to organize ourselves beyond, right, the state, racial capitalism, and the political. And so, yeah, that's my encouragement to organize.
Absolutely. Organize, organize, organize. Always, always good advice. I'm going to get us out on this before we get to the drop, because there was a line, well, a section where you talk about neoliberalism. Again, another word that is, you know, kind of been used as a punching bag a little bit, right? Like, you know, becomes so pervasive that it starts to lose all meaning at all, right? Everything becomes neoliberalism, but it is a very real and powerful sort of next level shot in the arm to the violence of capitalism. And we've experienced it for upwards of 40 years, maybe longer, depending on when your watch starts ticking on its sort of mutation within the capitalist story. But it is very real. And you reflect on it as white reconstruction, which I loved, because I reconstruction has long been a fascinating topic, most generally to me. And I feel in the United States we're Black people right now, Black and brown people, because you know you have to always say Black and brown people. we're at the end of another reconstruction. Like, it hasn't been called that, right? But it's 1876 here, right? Like, the federal troops have left, and ideologically I'm speaking, like the right is on the war path. I don't know if many people see it that way, but we're headed toward Plessy v. Ferguson type of reality. So whenever reconstruction comes up as a frame, I always love to spend a little bit of time discussing it. And I hadn't previously seen that notion of neoliberalism as white reconstruction. So I love the turn of phrase. I had it underlined in my notes with a question mark next to it. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of why that stuck out so much to make print in the book. And then we'll get to the drop.
I mean, the phrase white reconstruction is not my own, right? I'm really riffing off Dylan Rodriguez here, who's used this in other contexts. But in essence, right, the idea is that neoliberalism, right, really begins as a kind of counter-revolution or as a kind of counter-insurgency, right, that's fought against various social movements, right, not just in the US and across Europe, but also very much in the global south, right? So the idea here is that the 1970s, the early 1980s are moments of trade union organizing, right, in many ways, like across the globe, but it's also one of the Black Power movement, right, the various groups of people coming together to fight against the violence of the state. Of course, in the global south, we have right, still like ongoing struggles for decolonization, right, for like radically reforming the global political economy. And it's really, right, like from all of this that neoliberalism as a project is born as an attempt to really like crush what are like calls for justice and for freedom. And yeah, it's in that sense that I find that I really think that the kind of rollout of borders, but also mass incarceration, right, policing and of militarism, right, really in that sense needs to be seen as a kind of white reconstruction, right, as an attempt to really kind of tighten the hold of these communities.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, having lived through, continue to live through it and live through it in its heyday, Reagan 80s, not fun, not fun at all. But nonetheless, we persist, we resist, and we organize. So with that, I want to get us to the drop. And the drop is an opportunity to share anything at all with listeners. And my drop, given the kind of serious tone of this conversation, which I loved, by the way, my drop is so light. Like it's this show, it's a TV show called Superstore. And it's a comedy set in insert big box store of your choice, right? It's sort of this combination of a Walmart meets Target, and it's a comedy. It's kind of irreverent. And I actually didn't watch it during its original run, but I've kind of, like most people, kind of maybe find a show via streaming or pick it up. I started it over the holidays, and it's just light and fun, right? When you've kind of spent your days kind of doing whatever it is you're doing, and you're kind of looking for something that's easy, but also quite clever, because it does in its own way, in a very light way, kind of take on the foibles of so many of these types of stores. And here in the United States, and likely in other kind of Western nations, these big box stores like dominate, again, our retail imagination, right? No longer do you kind of go to the local people to do things. You kind of just, I could get everything at a Walmart and a Target. And these are also terrible stores toward organizing and paying a living wage. So they take that reality and make a little light of it. But there's actually an episode where they try to organize a union and, you know, the comic ways in which that kind of plays out. So Superstore is my drop. It's available here on Peacock. But I think overseas internationally, it's on Netflix. So that's my drop. So Ida, you're up.
My drop is a novel called Stolen. It's written by a Sami indigenous woman, Anne-Helene Listerdius. And I really wanted to mention this book because, I mean, I should say I grew up in Sweden, and in general in Scandinavia, there's very little knowledge of the fact that Scandinavia has been involved in a settler colonial project for, I mean, a very long time by now. And this is something that's very little talked about, not just internationally, but also in Scandinavia, right? Even though, I mean, there's been programs of sterilization, of incredibly violent boarding schools that have really forced Sami children to assimilate to kind of Scandinavian culture and so on and so forth. So this is a really important book for all of those reasons. And it's told as a story really about a young girl who witnesses her reindeer being killed by a Swedish man, but she's too scared to really tell anyone about this. And we then follow her as she grows up, kind of carrying this very dark secret. I think it's a very powerful book because on the one hand it really lays bare the violence of the Swedish state, as well as many multinational corporations that are active on Sami indigenous lands, right? There are various forms of energy projects there, timber extraction, various forms of mineral extraction, and so on. And quite often the Swedish police is complicit in all of this. And the book does a brilliant job in really kind of unraveling all of this. And then at the same time, I think it's also a very beautiful portrait of Sami cosmology, and especially this practice of reindeer herding, right? Which is kind of really portrayed in a way where reindeer are not just animals, right? And they're not just pieces of property, but they're rather a form of life. And I think there's a really beautiful resonance here with the idea that water is also life. And in that sense, right, an attack on the Sami reindeer is also an attack on their culture, on their spirituality, their normativity, and so on. And so, yeah, this is a wonderful book that I really recommend.
Oh, I'm definitely going to get that book. One, because it sounds like a wonderful story, but I'm not going to get us on another tangent. But I love reading and discovering ideas and notions and provocations that confront the, you know, what I call like the Scandinavian mythology. because here on the left, and I've referenced this on the show before and in many private conversations, Scandinavia, broadly speaking, so not just Sweden, but any of those states, Denmark and the rest, Norway, Copenhagen, they're often, not Copenhagen, but Finland, are often heralded as the nation state alternative to the United States, right? So if you're in a political perspective, it's like, well, what we're actually talking about is like how those state order operate. It's a Nordic model of perfection, right? Like America should be more like these perfect Nordic states that have figured out how to tax properly and govern properly and provide health care and all this kind of stuff. And I watched those, and you know, I confront it as like this Nordic myth, right? This notion that they're so perfect. And I'm like, well, that perfection again starts to crumble when more Black and Brown people move there, right? Then all of a sudden, people want to start to get rid of the universal health care. They want to start to pull back like the education. It's like, well, you're not really Swedish, so why should you get it? You're from Somalia, right? It's like, you know, so it's like the comfort level with these so-called universal things always seems to bump up against Black and Brown people, right? And no one, very rarely in these progressive circles, confronts that. And there's groups of organizers I know that I'm familiar with through my work that they go in the forest and they do all this stuff in Sweden, kind of talking about how we're going to build this better world. Never any indigenous folks there, never any Black people. There's just a bunch of white people sitting around a campfire and it just drives me nuts. I'm sorry. I kind of took your beautiful drop and turned it into a rant, but
no, that's very I'm excited welcome. To read the book. I'm very necessary. I mean, just to very briefly add to that, right? That like, of course, right? Like Sweden, Denmark and so on, right? Like these were empires as well, right? That were engaged in the enslavement economy and so on and so forth, right? It's just people don't really know about this. So I think, yeah, the book that I mentioned is one really, really important intervention in terms of trying to really destabilize, right, that Nordic mythology.
Oh, well, I'm going to look for it when we get off the phone. Like it's one of those things that just really boils me when I see it. You gotta confront all these mythologies. And your book, again, Resisting Racial Capitalism, an Anti-Political Theory of Refusal, literally, I think confronts so many foundational mythologies on how we think about the world and we think about the possibilities. So Ida, it's a wonderful book. I think it's a must read for anyone who's looking to deeply understand how we can do all of this better. And I want to thank you for coming on the deep dive with me. This is a great, great book and great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.